You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Opus Talks. I'm Colt Shaw, Senior Editor for U.S. Solar here at Opus, and on this episode, you'll learn about the build-out of the nascent American solar supply chain, its successes and challenges up to this point, and the policies and trade wars that continue to shape its trajectory. Joining us today is Mike Carr, Executive Director of the organization SEMA, or Solar Energy Manufacturers for America. Mike, thanks for coming on to chat. Would you mind introducing yourself and the kind of work SEMA is up to?
Sure. Thanks, Colt, for having me on. I appreciate the time. So I'm Mike Carr. I'm the executive director of the SEMA Coalition. It's the Solar Energy Manufacturers for America Coalition. We've been in existence now for a little over 3 years. We've grown from a core group of manufacturers who really looked at the landscape, who had been doing some production in the United States and felt like there was an opportunity and really a need to expand that production to avoid the monopoly that we were seeing form in China and Chinese headquartered manufacturing companies, and thought that there was a path forward to doing that. And so we got together in 2020 with some of our advocates, both in the administration incoming and in the Congress incoming, to see what we could do to try to put a framework in place that could allow solar manufacturing to become the force that we all believed it could be. You know, I think we're based on a fundamental proposition that there's no inherent comparative advantage in another place to build these things. American innovation, capital access, all the things that we tout really put us in a place where we should be able to be competitive and continue to drive down costs for solar in the United States. And I think we've begun to see that come to fruition as a result of some of the efforts in the Inflation Reduction Act, which we can talk more about later, and in the administration as we have worked with them over the last few years.
Thanks for that, Mike. Well, I think to kind of set the table for what we're, you know, for our conversation here, you're kind of helming SEMA at a time of really, I guess, massive change as a new domestic industry finds its footing, which is kind of rare in the U.S. in the last couple of decades. A series of tariff investigations over the last 10 plus years under both Democratic and Republican administrations have played a role in terms of bringing out this domestic industry, steadily bringing up the price of cheap imports, which have previously made it impossible for American module makers to compete. But as far as drivers go, like you had mentioned, the Inflation Reduction Act tends to dominate these conversations and is perhaps the single kind of signature policy achievement of the Biden administration in terms of domestic industry. It established the 45X and the 48C manufacturing tax credits, extended the ITC and PTC, and created the domestic content bonus for developers using certain percentages of American-made components, all aimed at spurring new factories in the U.S. It has done that, but in sort of a lopsided way to date, which we'll get into. But 2 years on since the IRA's passage, I'm wondering what you would say are kind of its big successes so far and kind of where it's fallen short in your estimation.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think you're right. These initiatives do represent a sort of a fundamental shift in the way the United States thinks about industrial policy, the way the government has worked to partner with industry. And I think just a general recognition or a discomfort with the way supply chains have been working over the last decade. And, you know, and to some extent, I think the COVID pandemic crisis really revealed some of these fault lines. And I think Congress and the administration returned from that with a renewed commitment to dig into these things. So you're right. You know, this is sort of a new turn for policy in the United States and a difficult challenge. I mean, I think we all need to acknowledge that up front, that we are up against a trading adversary that had a long-term plan and has been working at industrial policy for decades, and domination of supply chains, kind of in many, many areas, is part of the objective. So we had to kind of look at this from the perspective of being eyes wide open about that there would be reactions and that there would be, you know, counter moves put in place to not, you know, reset this balance between China and its trading partners. What we've seen is a tremendous amount of excitement initially when the bill was passed. I think the fact of the matter is, again, there is no inherent advantage in producing in China versus producing here. It's all a matter of sort of, you know, capital and fortitude. And I think a lot of companies, you know, looked at the landscape and said, okay, we think we have a path forward here. So there were a lot of initial investment excitement that resulted in a lot of announcements and a lot of fundraising. I think since then, a couple things have happened. One is there was concern in the developer community about disruption. I think that's natural. And so there was a lot of concern about particularly trade remedies that were on their own course that sort of came to fruition around the same time due to past dumping behavior. And there was a concern that maybe we couldn't scale up fast enough. And so they convinced folks that were very concerned about that, convinced the administration to put a moratorium in place in the hopes that we would continue to build manufacturing at the pace that had been announced. And, you know, there would be a smooth transition. As one might expect, that's just not the way, you know, well, not everybody wants the same outcome. That's not necessarily the way it played out. I think we saw a flood of imports that were very much not what the administration or advocates, I think, expected. And that has had significant price disruptions. Coupled at the same time, we had the initial take of the Department of Treasury on domestic content was less specific about the components than I think the industry had been expecting. And so it created a sort of an uncertainty about what kind of pricing could they really expect from that bonus. You know, would that necessarily require, for example, the production of wafers in the United States or even cells in the United States? I think that uncertainty coupled with the uncertainty around that this import surge led to a little bit of an extra layer of caution around some of these initial investments. We saw delays. We did see some cancellations, particularly in the most capital intensive pieces of the supply chain, because, you know, quite frankly, you know, the investors weren't willing to wait and, you know, sort of wait out that uncertainty. So I think that was a real bump in the road. Since then, you know, the tariff moratorium has expired has expired over to the summer, and that material is supposed to be used or tariffed by December of this year. And at the same time, the administration has made revisions to the domestic content bonus standard that have brought more clarity, and they have continued to have conversations. And I think also very publicly demonstrated their commitment to giving an enhanced value to a cell created with a domestic wafer. That has begun to kind of put a little bit of a security blanket around some of these investments. And I think those investments are ready to flow. Now, we do have the mega uncertainty now that we all sit in about an election coming in 3 weeks that could lead to a radically different direction. I don't expect that will most of the investors feel like they're quite ready until after that part is settled. But I think the future is really bright for these investments as long as we kind of stay on this same track that we're on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think out of all of that, I think one of the main kind of clear trends that's come to the fore is that announcements for new module assembly factories have just kind of far outpaced those for cell and wafer plants thus far, which you had kind of mentioned. And I'm wondering, and we've seen, you know, a couple of high profile kind of rollbacks like Cubic PV and Meyer Burger, who had cell plants kind of planned for the country and then have since kind of walked those back. I'm just wondering, I guess, just from an outside perspective, what would make a cell plant that much more complicated or costly? Or is there some other factor here that's led to such kind of depressed uptake compared to module or panel factories?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to kind of first and foremost understand that there's a very sort of standard capital versus risk allocation problem here. And a module factory is just by its nature, the quickest, easiest, and relatively cheapest thing to set up. It involves, you know, it's basically light industry. It's, you know, still good quality manufacturing jobs, but it is not the kind of capital intensity or sort of sticky asset that you can't pick up and move. And so it's just an easier hurdle to overcome. As you start to begin to kind of swim upstream in the supply chain, at each successive piece, you see more capital challenges, bigger capital commitments, you know, and sort of investments that are difficult to unwind. At a cell factory, you know, you have a lot of chemical handling, you have clean rooms, you have, you know, those kind of capital intensive facilities that are really hard to walk away from. And so you want to be pretty sure there's a market for your product. And in this case, that your domestic product will receive some favorable treatment or will be resistant to aggression from, you know, aggressive dumping from overseas. You know, as you get to wafer, you know, now you're talking about sort of heavy metal industrial processes. You're literally melting metal and growing ingots and putting in kind of the kind of facilities that are really, really tough to move and involve multiple hundreds of, to billions of dollars of capital commitments. And then at the polysilicon stage, you know, you're basically talking about a refinery, a large scale refinery. So, you know, it's perfectly natural that investors would get more and more concerned about the security of their investments as they climb that chain. And again, I think we did have real market disruptions. We saw some of the component costs drop far below what is, best we can tell, the actual production costs. And that includes things such as cells and wafers. Without the certitude that there would be some pushback from the government on that, you know, to kind of make it a level playing field that they thought that they were buying into when they saw the Inflation Reduction Act incentives, you know, I think you did see those pauses.
Well, I was going to say, I guess, like, given all of that, is it realistic, do you think, to expect that the U.S. could ever have kind of a share of that upstream supply chain? And if so, I guess, what could the U.S. be doing to, I guess, assure that those investors or attract them here in the first place?
Yeah, and I don't think anything's really changed on the possibility here. Fundamentally, we're talking about effectively taking sand, applying electricity, and turning it into a solar panel. It's a magical device, but it doesn't. The sand, in fact, you know, some of the highest purity sand that's used to make crucibles, in fact, it, you know, all comes from North Carolina, and so there's no built-in advantage other than commitment. And you know, if there's one thing that, you know, that I am certainly willing to give credit to the Chinese government for, it's commitment. And they have shown that sort of capital commitment through many cycles of the so-called solar coaster that people in the industry call this.
Speaking of that, it's kind of been one of the chief ironies that's kind of come out over the last year or so. And, you know, some mainstream publications have picked up on it too, but just the fact that Chinese companies, you know, JA, Jinko, Trina, Boviet, and others are responsible for, I think, almost more than half of the new solar module factories planned in the U.S. supply chain, at least those expected to come online in 2025. And so, obviously, this led to some pushback or some kind of alarm, and you saw a bipartisan group of senators in August float a bill to block companies from, quote, foreign entities of concern, namely China, from benefiting from these tax credits that we outlined at the beginning of this podcast. And yeah, I'm kind of wondering what's your view on that measure in terms of trying to kind of box out China from our own kind of domestic supply chain, and what would be the fallout of that if it were to actually get any traction?
Yeah, you know, this is something that was, I think, not completely unexpected. But I, you know, I'm sure some policymakers were caught off guard by the scale of it. I guess I should say at the outset that none of those companies are members of the SEMA coalition. And the rationale for that, I think, is kind of helps answer the question of how we feel about it. The rationale for that is that we believe to have a sustainable supply chain in the United States, it has to be the whole supply chain, and it has to be of a substantial enough scale that the equipment manufacturers will follow. And that's kind of how you have that manufacturing ecosystem that sustains itself and builds and continues to innovate. All the members of the SEMA coalition agree that is a critical piece of the puzzle. And the challenge that you get when you have folks such as you mentioned, that build the end stage, the module manufacturing stage here in the United States, is that they still retain all the advantages of those upstream subsidies, of those upstream cartel behaviors. And so, you know, what it allows them to do is essentially squeeze out or draft off of the most lucrative parts of the chain in order to continue to impede progress of the full supply chain build out. And I think that is the threat to the enterprise that you're seeing policymakers beginning to recognize and look at in this so-called FEOC legislation. I think, you know, it does need, our members will tend to agree that it is inappropriate for folks who can take advantage of those upstream supply chain inefficiencies or manipulation to take advantage of U.S. tax credits. But we're growing that industry. We're building it out now. And so, you know, we have to be at least conscious of how we regulate that and make sure that it doesn't impede the ability to, you know, get equipment to start this process or licensing or whatever it takes to get up and running so that we can get to that next level of manufacturing ecosystem where there are equipment suppliers in the United States, where there is, you know, again, the building of production, intellectual property, you know, that sort of state of improvement that a healthy manufacturing ecosystem exists in.
Just keeping the focus on Asia for the moment here, we saw the new doubled Section 301 tariffs on Chinese solar cells take effect last month. And that, you know, given most module imports to the U.S. Now come from Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Cambodia, that was kind of seen as a non-story. But in the same breath, trade officials said that they are considering applying that same 50% tariff to polysilicon and wafers out of China as well. Which could force some companies to rethink their supply chains entirely. Given that there's still an open comment period on this, I'm wondering if you expect the domestic industry to line up in support of this, and if you think it's likely to have any effect on the composition of the global supply chain.
You know, the history of this industry points towards China continuing to adapt and continuing to move facilities around. We're already starting to see it. That doesn't mean that these aren't useful actions by the federal government. Frankly, in this space, signaling matters, and just an administration that continues to signal that they are committed to the onshoring effort, you know, doing what is politically feasible. Obviously, you know, a ton of different things are in play in the trade relationship that we have with China and its sort of client countries. It is a constant give and take. I think the 301 tariffs that have been announced, we welcome that signal that there was, you know, there is a desire to continue to protect this build out of a solar industry in the United States. I think we welcome that. The details of it and the timing of it, which is always the challenge when you have, you know, an industry that is, you know, still fractured, that is still not, you know, kind of operating at peak efficiency, not fully built out. We have factories under construction across this country. In that circumstance, there will be a lot of different opinions about the right timing and the right places to apply pressure. I think as a coalition, what we can agree on is that some kind of backstopping by the government to enable this effort to continue is necessary, and the devil will continue to be in the details. And so we'll just have to kind of keep working through it piece by piece and continue to stay in constant communication with the administration about what is feasible and you know, where our challenges remain.
We also kind of find ourselves at an interesting time right now, as a lot of these module factories are starting to come online that came out of this IRA push. And I'm wondering what kind of prices you're seeing from domestic modules and what kind of spread you're seeing between those prices and imports from Southeast Asia. And what kind of spread do you think the market can ultimately bear as it kind of finds its footing?
I think it's a very good question. Pricing is a somewhat tricky question to answer because in solar, you kind of have to look at it at a few different places. There's not a fully formed spot market, say as, you know, as some of the other areas where you track in oil or gas markets. It is much more piecemeal, much more regional, and much more sort of bespoke, you know, and you have the differences between them with the residential market and the utility market require. And in different parts of the country, different kinds of panels and different kinds of technologies are sort of advantaged and disadvantaged. It is a deceivingly complicated answer to what seems like a simple question. One way to look at this is we experienced a dramatic and sustained growth in deployment of solar modules in 2022 and 2023. And in that time period, I think we were seeing pricing in the sort of 40 cents plus a watt range. We saw, again, you know, pricing that was very competitive, was cheaper than fossil, you know, was, you know, sort of leading, was on a very, very good growth trajectory. As we saw the moratorium and the sort of explosion of imports, you know, partly driven by a lot of factors, right? Overcapacity in China, the oversaturation of the European market, a lot of factors, I think, conspired to channel imports into the United States far in excess of our demands, you know, including continuing past the point where the market was effectively glutted. I think with that caveat, it's unclear if this is a real price trajectory or a short-term glut situation. But, you know, with that in mind, we have seen spot market prices sub 20 cents a watt, in some cases sub 15 cents a watt. And those could be one-offs, right? You could have a warehouse that is become oversaturated. You could have a canceled contract where people are just looking to dump panels. I think in the near term, more dumping of panels onto the market is probably likely, because if they're not sold or if they're not actually put to use or re-exported by December, they're subject to tariffs that in many cases might be more than the value of the modules themselves, which I think will perturb the market further for the next few months. Component prices similarly have crashed to the extent where we saw, you know, requests from some of the major manufacturers to the party in China to put on some kind of price controls because they thought this had gotten out of control. The market is what it is. There are not that many places where these panels can go. And I think, unfortunately, the United States has been like the market of last resort, where panels that just didn't have a home were going to be shipped here without regard to whether they were actually going to be able to be installed or absorbed. That's led to a spread, I think, that is far in excess of actual market fundamentals, as much as 20 cents a watt, which I think doesn't really reflect anything other than a broken market. In my conversations, both with developers and manufacturers, there's probably a comfortable place where everybody can live in the 30 cents a watt range, somewhere in there, where we think solar can grow very rapidly. Again, you know, PPA prices can continue to fall and stay below fundamentals for fossil. We can have a rapidly growing sector. And we think in the manufacturing space, that's something that people can live with and that they can make a living at. You know, I think the real key here is getting to the next generation of technologies. And I think, you know, I think it's important to keep our eye on that. You know, once the manufacturing base is built, new opportunities in tandem cells or advances in production technology can really take effect in that competitive marketplace. And so I think we can continue that march down the price spectrum, and eventually I think you can have an industry that can exist in the 20 cent range in the United States without subsidy once those improvements are allowed to happen. But we got to get on that technology improvement spectrum, and then we're just not there yet. So will there be a sustained spread? You know, that's really kind of up to Chinese manufacturers and ultimately the Chinese government on whether they will continue to push their economy to be export led. And the only way to do that is to sort of underprice competition in other countries. Again, I think the fundamentals are not so dramatically different that we necessarily have to have a sustained spread. I guess I should caveat all that by saying, in our mind, it is not a sustainable or, you know, it is not a sustained comparative advantage to not have labor or environmental standards around your production. And so I'm certainly not factoring that in as a fundamental advantage.
Well, Mike, I think that's a great place to leave it today. Thank you so much for your time and insight. This was super comprehensive, and I'm sure our listeners found it illuminating. I know I did. And yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing how all this plays out. So we'll have to do this again as new developments arise.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you very much. I had a great time.